The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest episode, the latest daring chapter of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, a very good day to you.
Good day to you, Mr. Parry. How's it going?
Yeah, pretty good, yeah. Going pretty good, thank you. Well, I say that, as you know, I'm an Everton fan, and when people tune into this, we will be, I'm estimating, 36 hours away from oblivion. Everton play Crystal Palace at home this week, and we really have got to beat them. And Crystal Palace are quite a useful team. And it's very, very tense, believe me. We lost our last game at home at Goodison Park to Brentford. Who would have thought of that? Somebody had told you that 5 years ago. But Brentford, a very small club in a very big league, have done terribly well. So that's why my nervous system is completely shredded, Miss Jones. If I start babbling or mumbling or look as though I've gone into, you know, catatonic shock, that's why.
Well, the thing is, what goes down has to come up.
Yeah, I don't want to go down, you know, thanks. We haven't been
but
down.
Nobody's, even if they do, nobody's down forever. Oh. There's only one way to go, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, you say that. Leeds, 17 years it took them to get back. Nottingham Forest have never got back since last time. Anyway, look, it's too sad to talk about. Let's talk about something much more cheerful, right? This coming weekend, the Sunday Times Rich List comes out. It does on an annual basis. And it was started, I don't know, 30 or 40 years ago, wasn't it, by one financial journalist listing the wealth of people in this country. And now, of course, it's a Bible. It's a Bible to the wealthy. But as I like wealth, and I think rich people are good people, because generally speaking, they've generated their own fortunes, I look forward to it and I can spend hours poring through it. My only regret is that when I get to the end of the list, I'm not there.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of it is guesswork. A lot of it's made up.
Yeah.
People don't declare their full wealth.
Mm.
So they're just estimating how much somebody's worth, what other assets they might have.
Yeah.
And it always leads me to think, why are we so obsessed with millionaires and billionaires? Mm. How does it affect the likes of you and I? When I was a kid, it was considered impolite to talk about money.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But nowadays, we love these rags-to-riches stories. Mm. We buy books by executives and people like Donald Trump to learn the secrets of amassing a great fortune. But according to money experts, it's something to do with a correlation between more money and increased happiness. And we know that that's not the case.
Well, it often is. People say, oh, you know, money's not everything, can't make you happy. I'll have a load of money, thank you, and then I'll decide whether I want to be happy or unhappy. No problem.
Hmm. I think we have some sort of complex, don't we, about people who are perceived to be doing better than us.
Well, I don't. To me, it encourages me. When I see people driving around in cars even I can't afford and living in, you know, in luxury penthouses by the River Thames or having baronial mansions in the Scottish Highlands or something like that, I'm not envious of them. I admire them. And I think, wouldn't that be nice? Have I got another plan to earn another few bob to see if I can achieve that? It makes me want to achieve. It doesn't make me envious at all. It doesn't make me depressed. It makes me happy.
I suppose it depends on how people acquire their wealth, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, family, if people just get this family money sort of handouts, it tends to make them a bit listless and without a point in life because they haven't had to try to achieve anything. But it's people that have worked and grafted from the ground up and that have made their wealth for themselves that tend to be the more interesting
people. Yeah, I totally agree. You talked about estimates and all that. I'm pretty sure it was Lord Sugar, and if it's not Lord Sugar, then I apologise. But somebody on the rich list actually complained to the compilers one year because they'd underestimated their wealth. So, you know, there is an aspect, not saying Lord Sugar is in this bracket, but there is an aspect of, you know, wanting others to know how wealthy they are. So I don't think I'd ever do that. In fact, to be honest, I never talk about, you know, my own assets and all that for a number of reasons. Firstly, the tax man's always going to be on your back. Secondly, you don't want to rub people up the wrong way. And thirdly, and it's happened to me a lot in my life, and I'm sure it has to you, if people know you've got a few bob, they will try to tap you. It might not be a straightforward, please, can you give me money? But they might approach you with some mad scheme to invest in or something like that. And I'm not saying that you've fallen foul of it, Miss Jones, but how many times do you read about somebody who's been young and successful and then has suddenly been hit on by one of these, you know, great investment opportunities and lost it all?
Oh, absolutely. I remember when my kids were small. Yeah. I went to a pretty decent school and there was a chap there who'd made his fortune with a chain of care homes
yes.
around the country.
Yes.
And he was absolutely loaded. He didn't have one Ferrari with a personalized number plate. He didn't have one Ferrari with that. He had five Ferraris with personalized plates. And he used to go to these dinner parties. Other dads around the table would always be trying to interest him in some scheme or another.
Right, yeah.
And he would always just say the same thing. You know, I don't do business with friends.
Yeah. No, that's a very good thing to say that because, of course, you can fall out. One guy who was a real rags to riches story is a guy called Charlie Mullins, okay? Now, Charlie Mullins started and was the owner of Pimlico Plumbers. It started off literally as a one-man plumbing outfit and then two men and three men. And then he expanded it into, you know, a very big plumbing business in London. So Pimlico, where's that? Is that in central London or?
It's just the other side of Chelsea.
Yeah, just the other side of Chelsea, so sort of West London. And then he expanded plumbing into, you know, plastering, bricklaying, and everything. And I think it was last year or the year before, he sold the business for $145 million. And he now lives in a, you know, lovely villa in Spain part of the time, a lovely place in this country. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, he's entitled to everything he's got. And I do like the fact that he now he involves himself in politics. So this headline from a newspaper I read just the other day, "Why I'll stop paying tax if civil servants don't return to the office," says Charlie Mullins. And he's making the point that the people he employed all the time, the 40 years that he ran his own business, they didn't have the choice for staying at home. They're plumbers and they're builders and they're bricklayers and they're van drivers, and civil servants can. And I think he's made a very good point there. I'm absolutely incensed that the, you know, the people in the civil service, particularly in London, just don't want to go back to their offices. And I'm glad that the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, you know, has had a go at them and said, get back.
I agree. We both had problems with our passports,
indeed,
didn't we? All those bureaucratic kind of nonsense things that were going on. I also struggled to get my new driving license for the same reason, because all those people are still working from home.
Yeah.
I think there is something about office culture that adds and improves something to the work ethic.
Yes.
You know, even if it's just that we measure ourselves up against the guy on the next desk or whatever, that there's a bit of a competitive streak, maybe. Mm. There needs to be an incentive.
I totally agree. That's what it's all about, incentive. You know, when you're in a competitive newspaper office, you want to get the best story. You want to beat the person sitting at the desk next to you. You as a showbiz writer would always want to get one over on not necessarily your own colleagues, but colleagues in other newspaper offices. But the culture within them all is the same, very competitive, you know. So it does drive me bonkers, that. Funny you should say about, did you say tax rebates? Because I've been waiting for a tax rebate, which I'm fully entitled to. It was investigated by my accountant. He went through it all. He spent months talking to HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenues and Collections, is it? Something like that. HMRC.
Her
Majesty's Revenue and something. I don't know.
Yes, I suppose it is Collections.
And Collections. And then the pandemic came, and then all of a sudden there was nobody in the offices, and now we still haven't got it. And this 3 years on, you know.
Well, I hope they're going to be paying you interest.
Well, that's a point my account's made. You know, this all seemed to... And the reason it hasn't been paid out is because we've discovered people are working from home and they can't liaise with each other on several different aspects of the claim and who's supposed to have signed it off and paid it. Anyway, look, fortunately, I'm not... on the breadline, so, you know, it's not stopping me from doing anything I want to do, but it's just a bloody nuisance. Talking about famous people, like Charlie Mullins is and Lord Sugar, do you read about Paul Hollywood?
Don't get me started.
Right, well, I find this very difficult to take. My Bake Off fame was not worth it, says Paul Hollywood, you know, the celebrity baker. And he says, I'll read this to you, he says, if I'd have known all this stuff was going to happen, the loss of my private life, no, I wouldn't have done it. He's talking about the programme Bake Off. I don't believe it.
Well, you know why he's coming up with all the stuff, because he's got a new cookery book coming
yes.
out. So this is all to do with promotion for his new book. And the very astute interviewer has asked him a couple of questions, which they then blow into the story.
Yeah.
So the story becomes how fame and fortune ruined my life, doesn't
yeah.
it? It's his own fault. He describes himself as a fat bloke from the Wirral. Mm. He was a baker. He worked in his father's family business and he worked his way up. He got picked to co-present Bake Off.
Mm.
He went off to America and did an American version of the show.
Yeah.
And he had an affair with his young co-presenter, Marcella Vladilic.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 2013.
Mm.
And so this caused a split with his wife, Alex, beautiful wife who he met in Cyprus. She was a scuba driver instructor.
Right.
And then suddenly it's all about the affair. So they've been married 20 years. Mm. They've got a lovely child. She was a beautiful wife.
Mm.
But he throws it all off the side for a bit of midlife nookie.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is really the root of the problem, not the fact that he's made some money or that he's famous, but that he regrets having an affair and that his marriage broke up.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely true. I'll read the quote. He says, anything to do with family, you have to be careful. Trying to maintain family relationships is really difficult when they're in the public domain. But you're absolutely right. He went off and, you know, picked up a younger bird and then blames it on his fame as though it's what famous people have to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's a bit stupid,
yeah,
isn't it? And he obviously regrets it. He can't get it back because he went back to his wife, but then he had another affair with a barmaid.
A lady called Summer.
Yes, dreadful girl. She's vanished off the face of the earth.
Oh, that's a bit harsh. Miss Jones, a bit harsh.
No, not at all. Somebody who was a bit of a chancer who was working in the local pub, and he was a bit down on his uppers, and she spotted an opportunity because he's a TV star.
Mm. Well, she then employed Splash Agency. I noticed this every time I saw a picture of it in the paper. So you're absolutely right. It, you know, I'm not accusing her of manipulation, but it looks like her association with Paul Hollywood, who she suddenly walked out on one day, didn't she, and said, it's not right, I'm coming out. Then expected, I think, I can't remember her surname now, but her first name was Summer.
Monty's Fulham.
Oh, that's right, Monty's Fulham, yeah. Then expected to be hailed as a beauty who'd just been discovered and she's going to become an international model and all that. As you quite rightly say, I haven't seen a picture of the poor girl for quite a long time. But then...
She's got nothing to offer, has she, really, other than the fact that she had an affair with him.
Well, you may be right. And we will start talking about things other than Paul Hollywood in a minute. After that finished, I think he went back to the same pub and started a relationship with the lady who's the manager of the pub. I mean, you know, it's...
The landlady, yes. This is in the Checkers Inn in Smarden.
Oh, right, okay.
It's a very beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. What I would say about it is that, you know, at some stage in my life, I've been like a kind of Z-list celebrity. You know what I mean?
I would have said more B-list, Mr.
Well, Blake. No, I'd say more Z. And sort of, you know, people will pass you in the street and they'll say hello. People will ask if they can have a picture taken with you. We did a... Two or three.
And we had that, didn't we, in that pub that time when the guy on the next table was surreptitiously trying to take pictures of
you. That's right, absolutely.
And you said to him, what is it you want, a picture or something?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. No, it's absolutely true. You know, I did, like, National Theatre tours for 2 or 3 years and the adulation was enormous. in the sense that you would meet some of the crowd afterwards and they were all pissed and all worked up and they'd loved the show and all that kind of stuff. And I have to be honest, I liked being at the centre of it. You know, it made me feel good. I thought, gosh, I've got a talent and people pay to come and see me and all that kind of stuff. So I don't get this, you know, fame is onerous and, you know, I hate fame and all that. Anybody who says that is lying. One time I was with Rod Stewart, and I'm sure you've been in the company of Rod Stewart and you've been in the company of Sir Paul McCartney, and I just discussed it with him and he said, no, you know, nothing wrong with fame, mate. If I wasn't famous, I wouldn't have been successful in my job, would I? And that's the answer to it, really. You're famous because you've done something special that other people can't do.
Well, what Paul Hollywood is really saying, that fame, he's blaming fame for him having had an affair. Yeah. And actually, the only person he can blame for having an affair is himself.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Talking again about famous people, right? Do you watch The Chase?
Oh, I love The Chase. Yeah. It's my favourite thing. Yeah. That and Michael Portillo's Train ones.
Oh, really?
Like
those as well.
Oh, those are my two favourite programmes. Yeah. Well, whenever I'm home in the afternoon, I always watch The Chase. Yeah.
Well, I like The Chase a lot. If I'm back home by five, you know, I would usually have put on the some music while I was making dinner or something like that. But after you said you like The Chase, I had a look at it. I love Bradley Walsh. I think he's great. And it's captivating and riveting. But there's, I forgot his name now, the bloke who's the beast, right?
Mark Lebet.
Mark Lebet, that's right, yeah. Great guy.
Yeah, that's interesting because you know French for the beast is Lebet.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that's probably why he's got the nickname.
Well, I would think so. You're absolutely right, yeah. And I didn't realise he's 6'6" tall because it's difficult to tell when they're sitting at the top of the, whatever it's called, you know. And so I read now that, and they do lots of public appearances, these people, and there's a live Chase show on the road. He's now taken on a minder because of the number of times he gets sexually assaulted. Which is quite interesting, isn't it?
Why?
Well, because women were grabbing his private parts.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, that is common assault, isn't it?
Well, exactly. But again, when I said to you, we used to do these, you know, these theatre shows, live shows, and all that. That happened to me all the time. All the time, women would get up close to me and start trying to molest me. Right? And I mean, I know
what they what they were grabbing your bits.
Yes. Yes.
Seriously?
Particularly your bum. They'd always want to squeeze your bum, you know what I mean? But, you know, a few of them would get a bit more adventurous than that. And, of course, I'm no great oil painting at this stage of my life, although, you know, I can see how attractive I've been in my earlier life. But, yes, modest, aren't I?
Always, Mr. Parry.
But it wasn't just that. It was that they'd start flashing at you. You know, pulling their tops down.
Flashing what?
Well, you know, they'd pull the top up or pull the tops down or something like that. Or
what? They show you the goods.
Yeah, yeah.
And what kind of a person does that?
I don't know, but they'd also, you know, they'd pull the skirt up and flash their legs and
no way. Yes, oh, that's
yes.
Oh, that's outrageous.
Yeah. So you know, all this used to happen. So
you sure you didn't pay them to do that?
No, I can assure you, I didn't. You know, because at that stage we were trying to run from the theatre and that kind of stuff.
I tell you what, on that subject, years ago, I was on the road with Julio Iglesias
Julio.
In Germany, and he had a gaggle of young girls outside his dressing room door,
right.
And a PR whispered in my ear that they were on the payroll and they were paid to do that, to make it look as though he was very desirable.
Oh, I see.
Because he was sort of on the turn at that stage, wasn't he?
Well, I see.
Yeah, so they actually pay fans to hang around
outside,
make him look good. Are you sure you weren't paying those women?
I can assure you I was not paying those women, Miss Jones. I didn't even know the women, you know what I mean? But, you know, you got lots of offers of phone numbers and all that kind of stuff. So,
did you take them up?
Never. I never got back. There's one lady and she was...
It all comes out.
She was with her husband and they were just great fans, you know, of the two mics. They were great fans of me from going back years on Talk Sport. We forged a bit of a friendship, to be honest. And, you know, they were regulars at all the shows all around the country and all that kind of stuff. And we'd let them come into the backstage to the dressing room afterwards and have a few drinks with them. But that's as far as it went. And she was always with her husband, you know, so it wasn't, there was nothing insidious about it, believe me.
Yeah, I believe.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Miss Jones, I know you you visit the coast a lot these days, and I don't blame you. You like the sea air and that kind of stuff. Do you, wherever you go, do you see beach huts?
Yeah.
And the reason I...
In fact, my cousin has a beach hut down at Birchington, I want to say, somewhere like that.
Where?
Birchington, oh, yeah. In Kent. It costs her about 30 grand a year.
Well, you see, the beach hut phenomenon is just getting ridiculous. Another beach hut has gone in somewhere near my other home in Suffolk. Is it Waldingham or somewhere like that? I can't remember. Southwold.
Southwold, that's a very trendy place.
Yeah, it is Southwold. A beach hut there has gone for £350,000. And guess what? There's no lighting and there's no sanitary facility. So it hasn't got a loo and it hasn't even got electricity. And it's gone for £350,000 simply because it's there on the beach and faces the sea. And it's yours forever if you own it. And you're absolutely right. To rent them out, it does cost what you've been saying. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, it is. I was down in Dorset a few months ago with my old school friend, yeah, Julie, and we went to some Dorset beaches, beautiful beaches down there.
Yeah.
And she showed me a little sort of strip where the beach huts are going for 150 grand a year.
Absolutely.
In rent.
Yeah.
And I said, this is crazy.
Yeah.
They haven't got electricity. They haven't got gas. They've got no, as you say, no plumbing.
Yeah.
So what is it? I think it must be, it's not the hut itself. It's that bit of real estate. So if your hut burnt down,
yeah,
or you decided to chuck that hut away, do you still own that little plot of beach?
Well, I don't know. And if you did, you'd have to build a new hut on it, but you couldn't put the electric and the old pipes
no,
in.
No, but you could go down B&Q and get a shed and stick it on that bit of real estate. So what I'm wondering is it the bit of beach that's worth the money?
Well, it's location, isn't it? That's what it's about all the time. I mean, location, location, location. And that's what gets them. But my family live down in Dorset, and there's a place there called Muddiford, right? And
That's where we were, yeah,
Muddiford.
Yeah.
And it's a spit. So it's like a little peninsula of land with a lovely old pub at the end of it. We often walk over there. You can either get the boat, the ferry, or you can drive to a point where you park your car and then walk down the spit and go there. It's lovely. And the huts there are regularly changing hands for £250,000. I mean, the most exotic place around there is Sandbanks, okay? But Sandbanks now is so incredibly wealthy, or the real estate is so incredibly valuable, they don't have beach huts. They need all the space they can to build £10 million homes, you know?
Yeah, it is lovely down
yeah.
there. My friend Penny from college, they've got a place right on the beach there,
yeah,
and it's glorious. It could be I don't know, Malibu. It's so beautiful.
It is.
The only thing we don't have is the reliable weather.
Well, exactly.
Other than that, you could be anywhere in the world.
Yes, you could. But as I'm not a weather person myself, I like it when it's more temperate, so it would be absolutely perfect for me. Miss Jones, you are sometimes the seer of doom. You know, during the pandemic, you were always very pessimistic about how it's going to get worse and we're all going to face a terrible fate. Have you heard about the latest threat to national health, which is monkeypox?
I'm a bit worried about this. I read these stories. They sort of drip feed them, don't
yes.
they, the monkeypox? Is this one that we need to get our knickers in a twist about, do you think?
Well, I can't believe that Fleet Street hasn't already. When I used to work on tabloid newspapers, they were far more sensational than they are even these days, OK?
And, that's true.
And do you remember that there was a minor report about somebody being admitted to hospital with a skin disease, which we then turned into a flesh-eating bug, which we then turned into, you know, something that had come from Mars and devoured people's skin, and we were all going to die of it, and it became literally a national panic. People were going around wearing three sets of clothes so the bug couldn't get them and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I do remember that. I mean, we were quite good at spinning stories, I suppose, back in the day.
We were.
There's less of that now. Maybe there are more legal restrictions. I don't know.
Yeah.
But monkeypox, every time I read about it, I think, I don't really want to know about this. It's yet another thing to worry
You're
about.
You're right. Another four cases have been reported. And I've had a look at the symptoms, and it's quite unpleasant. It's like scabs on your body, you know what I mean? It says it's not lethal and it goes after 3 or 4 days, but who wants to be walking around with, you know, sores and scabs on your arms and that kind of stuff, and particularly in this sort of weather? Anyway.
What the thing that bothers me about it is that we've reached a stage in evolution where these diseases that are confined to certain species are now jumping species. So they're crossing from one species to another. So from apes to humans. Mm. And this is the first time, I believe, in evolutionary history that this kind of thing is happening.
My God.
Which, of course, is why we got the coronavirus.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. And the other thing that worries me is that penicillin is becoming less and less good as a combatant to disease in human beings, because we
less effective.
Yeah. We now become immune to it.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for tuning in today to Life on Planet Porky. Miss Jones, we've had some fantastic responses recently to the podcast. They seem to be greeted with great enthusiasm these days. Maybe it's because we're all out of lockdown now and people feel freer.
I think that's true, yes. Mm. People are getting back to their lives.
Yeah.
And routine is really important. Mm. That was one of the things we were all struggling with when we were locked up.
Yeah.
For all those months, it's very hard to establish a routine at home by yourself.
Yes.
And you need that sort of thing of getting out of the house, going to your work, going to meetings, doing all that stuff, and having a structure to your life, to your diary. That's hard to maintain, which is another reason why get back to work, you know. Mm. But routine I depend on very much. Yeah.
No, I do as well. Now, what does this remind you of, Miss Jones? You take my breath away. And this other one. I live in the danger zone. How about that, eh?
Well, that's got to be Top Gun, hasn't
exactly, it? Exactly, it has. And guess what? I think it's in 2 weeks' time, the new Top Gun, which is called, I think it's called Top Gun Maverick, also starring Tom Cruise, has been released. And as an avid Top Gun fan, I tell everybody, I always nominate that as the best film I've ever seen. I can't wait for it to come out. I'm actually going to go to the cinema on my own, probably, unless I can drag somebody along with me, to watch the sequel, because all the reviews I've read so far says it's even better than the first one. But I suppose Top Gun is not really your cup of tea, is it, Miss Jones?
I never saw Top Gun. I'm not a Tom Cruise fan. I don't like military-style movies anyway.
Yeah, sure.
I don't like anything with that sort of connotation of warfare. Mm. So, it's not going to be my cup of tea, I'm afraid. Did you see Tom Cruise at the Queen's Windsor horse show thing?
I was wondering, what's he doing there? You know what I mean?
Exactly that. Yeah. I sat there thinking, first of all, he's an American.
Yes.
Second of all, he's nothing to do with the royal family or the Queen. What exactly is the connection here?
Yeah, I agree with that as well. And by the way, I'm not a Tom Cruise fan. The only film I've ever liked him in is the original Top Gun, because that was really his debut film, if you see what I mean. And there he was, you know, young actor coming out of Hollywood, got the opportunity, played it very well. But after that, his whole attitude to life changed. I mean, he became a Scientologist. That's up to him. No problem at all. But, you know, that involved some strange sort of beliefs and decisions, which, you know, always to me affects the individual's ability to be seen as an actor. And also, I felt that after Top Gun, when I did see the odd film now and then, like what's that series he does, Mission Impossible or something like that, the whole film seemed to be built around emphasising what a huge hero and very brave person and supernatural man the character was that Tom Cruise was playing.
Well, that's quite indicative of insecurity, isn't
it? Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I totally agree. You know, you never got that feeling with Sylvester Stallone in Rocky or the Rambo films. You know, he played it as really a loser trying to make good, you know. But you always saw it with Tom Cruise. Anyway, look, I'm probably being far too critical. No, Miss Jones.
Is this what they call short man syndrome or small man syndrome or something? Because he wears lifts in his shoes, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right. It could well be. Napoleon was very short. And the guy who ran Formula One for many years, who's got
Bernie Eccleston,
thank you. He was even shorter. But look, good luck to them for getting on with it. Now, Miss Jones, we have talked in the past about John Deacon, the bass player for Queen. You know a lot more about it. You've written books about it and that kind of stuff. And I don't want to go over old ground, except that I saw Brian May talking about it recently, and it was very poignant because Brian May, of course, the, you know, Goldilocks star of Queen, the lead guitarist, he actually said that after Freddie Mercury died, John took it very badly, went away, and none of them have ever been in touch with him since, except through lawyers and, you know, discussions about royalty checks. I think that's very sad when a group of people work together as they did and create legendary music and a legend in terms of, you know, rock history. Isn't it sad they don't communicate?
Well, it is. But of course, there's more to the story.
Yeah.
There always is more to a story like this. What I'm fascinated by is why Brian is talking about this now, because it's been the case for a long, long time. Freddie Mercury died in 1991.
That's right.
So it's coming up 31 years ago. Mm. John Deacon lost his father when he was 11 years old, and he was too stunned to grieve at the time. And he was just a little boy. He didn't know how to.
Really? When he was 2 years of age? That's amazing.
When he was 11 years
old. Oh, 11, I'm sorry, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And he didn't know how to grieve, so he got on with his life. He joined the band that became Queen, and he was the youngest in the lineup, and he was very close to Freddie. They were all collectively and individually close to Freddie.
Yeah.
When Freddie died of AIDS in 1991, John went to pieces because he, there and then, started to grieve for his father. Freddie was a bit of a father figure to him.
Right.
So he lost his father twice, was the psychology behind it.
Yeah.
And he crumbled. He went off the rails. He, first of all, said something very true, which I believe to this day, which is that without Freddie Mercury, there can be no Queen.
Right.
Queen have maintained this 30-year career beyond the death of Freddie, which I find rather suspect, to be honest. Yeah. I think they should have left it and called it a day.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They soldiered on in Freddie's memory. Mm. Well, that was their decision. Mm. Fair enough. As far as John was concerned, there was no Queen without Freddie Mercury.
Really?
And he didn't want to carry on. He expressed his wishes to the others and they disagreed and they soldiered on. So obviously he still earns money from the catalogue, the recorded catalogue.
And the film, I think.
And the film. Yeah. So he's still getting paid.
Yeah.
But also he did a few foolish things. He went off the rails a bit. Mm. He started having an affair with a lap dancer. He bought her a flat. He bought her a car. Mm. He bought her mother a car. Mm. Then his wife, Veronica, found out all about it and she dragged him home. They've got five kids between them, obviously grown up now.
Yeah.
But and she sort of kept him in the house and he became a recluse. Mm. And you see photos of John sort of wandering around now and stuff. He looks like a wizened old man.
Yeah, I saw a picture of him and it was a very rare picture. He looked bald and he had a shabby old coat on and a very expressionless face, you know, like he'd kind of given up on life, really. But look, you know, he was part of something which was absolutely huge, wasn't it, Queen? You know,
it was, but it's a long time ago.
Yeah,
and
these
people are in their 70s now. Mm. What are they supposed to look like? You know, people in their 70s do look old.
Yeah. Well, Rod doesn't, does he? But then again,
Rod Stewart, he does a bit. I think he does a bit. I mean, the hair's a little bit thinner now.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And he's been had a bit too much sun, hasn't he, over the years?
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, that's Rod, isn't it? Malibu and all that kind of stuff. So he got on with it. Talking about very famous rock stars or very famous musicians, Bob Dylan's opened his own museum of memorabilia. And it surprised everybody because nobody knew that he'd collected a lot of memorabilia, but he's owned it in Tulsa, in Oklahoma, And apparently it's an enormous collection of just things like, you know, programs from his concerts, ticket stubs, clothing, things that he's picked up along the way in his life, a guitar here and all this kind of stuff. And nobody knew it was happening. But I didn't know he was a public person, Bob Dylan.
Well, he's not. So rather than put himself out there, he's put all his junk out there, hasn't he?
It's you call it junk? That's a bit harsh, isn't it?
No, I don't mean to be rude by saying that. Sorry, I mean, okay, all his possessions, all his bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones, obviously, who retired from the Stones some years ago, he was the collector in that band and had all the programs, the tickets, the plectrums, the, you know, book matches, all of this stuff collected from all over the world. They become a bit obsessed by it and they become sort of personal archivists, their own archivists. And we know the longer you keep something, the harder it is to throw it away.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
And I think every family house is a bit like that.
Yeah.
We've all got a museum, haven't
we? I've got a pretty impressive collection. I've got football programmes going back to 1938, okay, which obviously they're not games I attended, even though some would say I'm old enough to have gone to a game in 1938.
How very rude.
Yeah, very rude, yeah. But, you know, I've acquired some of them from programme collectors, but I do have a huge collection of programmes from games that I went to. But I have other things as well. Right from the start of my career in journalism, if I was sent on a foreign job, I would make sure I took something back with me. So, for instance, one of the first jobs I ever did, I was sent to the Lebanon via Israel to report on the War of Galilee. I can't remember which one it was, but it was. And the only way I could get there when the office wanted me there was first class on LAL Airlines, okay, which, as you can imagine, was A, the safest airline in the world because of the security, but B, it was absolutely luxurious. And I picked up, they gave you a present. They give, you know, usually on airlines, and I'm sure you know better than me, they give first class passengers a little present. It might be a leather bound toilet bag or something like that with all the stuff in it, you know, or something. And they gave me a cube, a glass cube with a shell inside it, which had been picked up, you know, from the shores of the Dead Sea or something like that. You know what I mean? And I remember thinking how wonderful this is. And I kept it and I've still got it. In fact, it's on my windowsill in one of my rooms. And that's going back about, believe it or not, about 40 years or something. And ever since then, I've always tried to bring something back. So when I did South Africa, the World Cup, I brought back a Vuzelu, whatever it was called. You know, those things that they were blowing all the time, you know. Boo, boo, boo. Is it a Vuzelu?
Oh, yeah, those awful things.
Yeah, that's right. And
I know what you mean. Yeah.
And the other thing I've collected throughout my life is if you go to a sporting event, these days it's changed. These days you have to flash your phone because your phone's got something encrypted on it and that gets you through the gate, you know what I mean? But for years I collected the lanyards that they gave you to identify you, and I've got hundreds of them from, you know, the Grand National, the Epsom Derby, England international matches at Wembley and all over the world, European Cup finals, boxing matches, and I've got a huge collection which I have put together on an easel, you know, an artist's easel that you put a board on in my house. I had one and I thought, what should I do with that? And I thought, I know, I'll collect all my lanyards and put them on. And I've collected them. There's over 300. And I won't throw those away.
Yeah, because you kept them and they're symbolic of your life as a journalist.
Yes.
So, you know, why would you keep them? I tell you what I used to collect when we were flying around the world, you know, sometimes 2-3 times a week, weren't we, on planes transatlantically. I collected sick bags.
Sick bags?
Sick bags.
What did you collect those for?
Because I wanted to collect something that gave an indication of how I'd spent those journalistic years.
Yeah.
But I wanted to collect something that nobody else was collecting.
Right.
And then I was out for dinner, years ago this is, with Simon Kinnersley, who you may remember
right,
from Fleet Street. And we were chat, you know, about the good old years on Fleet Street and stuff. And he said, oh, you know, I have my memorabilia from those years. Yeah. I used to collect sick bags. Oh, and I said, you're joking. And I said, no. And I said, so did I. And he said, you're joking. And I said, no. Mm. Oh, we couldn't believe that we both picked the same thing to collect.
Are those, I mean, I remember, I've never used a sick bag on a plane, fortunately, quite lucky. But you used to see them stuck on the, you know, into the back of the seat in front of you. I don't remember them being logoed with the, were they all logoed with the sign of the airline?
I've got some with Pan Am on. Of course, Pan Am no longer exists.
That's right, yeah.
So that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
And the British Airways always had a little sort of tick in the corner.
Yeah, yeah.
In blue and red, that kind
amazing.
Of stuff. Did you ever fly Concorde?
Yes, only the once, but I did.
So did you get any sort of present on Concorde?
Do you know, I honestly can't remember, but the strangest thing happened. When Concorde was decommissioned, I got a knock on the door one day, I opened it, and I was delivered from British Airways a picture of Concorde flying over London, and it was personally signed by the Concorde test pilot.
That's interesting, because when I flew Concorde a few times, yep. and I got given presents on board.
Right.
So I got a certificate each time right. to say I'd broken the sound barrier
yeah,
on really, a plane.
Yeah.
So I've got those somewhere. Mm. I got a little grey folder, you know, with silver kind
yeah.
of embossing
yeah.
on.
Yeah, I think I've got one of those. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, silver picture frame. There was one. Yeah. There was a beautiful notebook that was all engraved and stuff.
Yeah.
So they used to give out presents.
But they must have kept a register of their passengers, you know, forever, because I couldn't, it was years and years after I'd flown on Concorde that it was taken out of the air, unfortunately, because it used to fly over my penthouse pad in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey. And I used to go out into the roof garden 4:45 every night if I was home from work after doing the breakfast show or something. And I used to just stand there in wonder watching the Concorde flash overhead. You know, it was brilliant. But anyway, there we are. I did collect all the wash bags that they gave you if you flew.
Oh, yeah. I had hundreds of those. I used to give them away to people.
And me. They just took too much space, honestly, in the end. But yeah. I never used them because I always had my own stuff, so I didn't need to. But I brought them home and I stacked up and then thought, God, I've got a wardrobe full of them here. You know, I have to get rid of them. But you're absolutely right. Now, Miss Jones is one of the world's most successful writers, hence the title Rock Chick Writer Extraordinaire. I can't believe what I'm reading about J.K. Rowling, obviously herself a very successful writer.
Rather more successful than me, I would say.
Well, I wouldn't say so. I mean, there's only one J.K. Rowling, but I would say in the bracket in which you write, there's only one Rock Chick Writer Extraordinaire. So,
you're very
good. Yeah, so I would take the title. But she says, and this is absolutely fascinating, you'll know more about it than me, she's working on 6 books at the moment. She works on more than one book at once. I can understand maybe her getting writer's block on something she's doing and turning to start another one. That would be 2, but 6?
Well, the thing is, you don't write 6 books simultaneously.
Yeah.
You are researching one, you're planning another one, you're interviewing for something else. Mm. There are all kinds of phases of putting a book together. And frankly, you have to be working on more than one at a time
yeah.
in order to keep up with the publishing mm-hmm. schedule.
Right.
So because it takes such a long time to actually write a book
yeah.
and you've got publishing commitments dating ahead on average 5 years, mm-hmm. you've always got a delivery date looming.
Yeah.
And so books, yes, they're on your desk, on your computer in different phases of development.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, but I mean, you must be.
I'm working on 5, but they are scheduled over the next 6 years.
Really?
And yeah, so I'm putting things into those various files on my computer
wow.
all the time.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well done, Miss Jones. I'm glad to see that you're so industriously busy. Listen, I read a piece. It's probably a bit of malicious gossip, but you know what we're like, us journalists are like gossip.
Oh, yes, we do.
We certainly do. And Naga Munchetti, who does the...
Oh, I can't stand her.
Well,
she's horrible.
That's a bit harsh. Naga Munchetti, who does the breakfast show on the BBC, along with a guy called Charlie State...
He's lovely.
Yeah,
we like him.
...is accusing Charlie of blanking her and ignoring her. And they did one particular feature where Charlie had to go outside to get on a bike with somebody, some, you know, issue involving cycling and all that kind of stuff. And she complained he didn't come back, i.e., you know, he didn't come back to support the rest of that section of the show. He went off and had a cup of tea with the cyclists and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you can fall out with people at work and it can get quite harsh. It's pretty well known that I fell out with somebody I worked with for a long time and it was a very bitter breakup. But this is a bit more public, really, and I'm not sure if it's very good for the viewer to see two people working together who are now said to be at odds with each other.
Well, it's the same thing as falling out with your next door neighbour, isn't it? You can't afford to do that because you've got to see those people every day.
Yeah.
So you might as well make the best of it and put on a united front. Mm. I think she's very foolish to air this laundry in public.
Yeah, I do as well, to be honest, because I've had loads of very great broadcasting partners, Alan Brazil, Andy Townsend. You know, I've worked with some great, great people, and also in news as well as sport. But occasionally it gets fractious, and the one thing you can't do, you're absolutely right, is to suddenly start having a go at each other on air. In fact, one time I was working with a guy called Paul Breen Turner. Okay. Paul's a lovely lad. He's based in Spain. He's British, but based in Spain. Did very well there as a broadcaster and a property investor and all that. And he would come over, you know, in the summer for a month or something like that, do some shows. And we had a terrible spat on air one time. Something happened in the break, you know, which, you know, I objected to something he said or he objected to something I said. And we took it back on air and it was dreadful. And, you know, I got the top boss of the station, you know, demanded to see me after the show and said it sounded dreadful, terribly unprofessional. And that is a fact. I mean, you've got to be able to work together. I saw Eamon Holmes talking recently again about the time he called his female partner, Little Miss Tippy Toes.
Remember? Oh, Anthea Turner.
Anthea Turner, yeah. And he said in the piece I read, you know, it was unfortunate, but these things happen. But it can be a difficulty.
Yeah, I think it can. I think you've just got to make the effort. You can't fall out with anyone who you have to see regularly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've just got to pretend.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. Miss Jones, you're a bit of a, you know, fan of France. You were educated there.
Oh, I love France. Yeah, love France. Yes, I did go to college in Paris.
Yes, that's right. I love France. It's a great country, but I'm fed up to the back teeth with their ruler, Mr. Macron. I think the guy's a weasel. I think he's trying to cozy up to the world's most despicable man, Vladimir Putin, ogre who's bullying, killing, torturing and raping the people of Ukraine. And all Macron can do, instead of showing the sort of support that this country has shown, weapons and wholehearted support for the Ukrainian people, he's cozying up to Vladimir Putin all the time. I'm pretty disgusted by him.
I think you might be being a little bit harsh. I've read that France has sent a lot of military equipment to Ukraine. Mm. Paris and Berlin have decided not to interfere directly, and so have we, by the way, because this war will escalate into global conflict, World War III, in other words.
Yes, okay.
What Macron is saying, that stopping dialogue with Putin would mean leaving negotiations to more sinister powers, such as Erdogan in Turkey and Xi Jinping in China.
Yeah, well.
So, it's right that we try and negotiate with Putin as best we can, but we can't excuse the atrocities going on in Ukraine. So, of course, Ukraine gets all our support. I do think he sits on the fence a little bit, Macron.
Yeah.
You're right. There is something sort of elitist about him.
That's right.
Do you think he sort of crystallizes some sort of class hatred?
Well,
I know that French society is very anti that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, he hates the British because we got out of the European Union and he's got to be seen to be punishing us to deter any other country like Italy from coming out of the European Union. So that also makes him a very unpleasant person, in my view. We've got the conflict of the agreement in Northern Ireland, you know, the protocol and all that. So I just don't like him. I think he's slimy. Many people, you know, have a lot to say about Boris and his faults and all that. But I think he's been far straighter in his view. You know, I'd love to see him in that boat the other day with a leader of Sweden, was it, or Finland, one of the two. And there we are.
Finland, I think, yeah.
Right, okay. All right, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed for having joined me, and to everybody who's listened, because obviously we're at the end of it now, thank you very much indeed for tuning in again. I think by the time you listen to this, folks, the skies will be ablaze with sunshine. So let's all hope we have a very good week, and me in particular, that Everton survive in the Premier League. Until next time, folks, goodbye. All the time, women would get up close to me and start trying to molest me, right? And I mean, I know
what... They were grabbing your bits?
Yes, yes.
Seriously?
Particularly your bum. They'd always want to squeeze your bum, you know what I mean? But, you know, a few of them would get a bit more adventurous than that. And, of course, I'm no great oil painting at this stage of my life, although, you know, I can see how attractive I've been in my earlier life. But, yes, modest, aren't I?
Always, Mr. Parry.
But it wasn't just that. It was that they'd start flashing at you, you know, pulling their tops down.
Flashing what?
Well, you know, they'd pull the top up or pull the tops down or something like that, or...
What, they show you the goods?
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of a person does that?
I don't know, but they'd also, you know, they'd pull the skirt up and flash their legs and
no oh, yes, way. Yes, oh, that's...
Yes.
Oh, that's outrageous.
Yeah, so, you know, all this used to happen, so...
You sure you didn't pay them to do that?
No, I can assure you I didn't, you know, because at that stage we were trying to run from the theatre and that kind of stuff. What I would say about it is that, you know, at some stage in my life, I've been like a kind of Z-list celebrity, you know what I mean? And
I would have said more B-list, Mr. Bray.
Well, no, I'd say more Z. I live in the danger zone. How about that, eh?
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.